All right, recording started. Welcome to the November 27th Aries Working Group call, the U.S. afternoon call. We have a good agenda today, have lots of stuff to talk about, and looking forward to the upcoming Connectathon that is happening next week, and more about that in a minute. Please remember the Hyperledger Code of Conduct, the antitrust policy. Let's be nice to each other and avoid doing anything illegal that would encumber the work that we do so that it could be used far and wide. Please add yourself to the attendee list if you have not already. Grateful for those that have. Is there anyone that would like to introduce themselves that hasn't been on the call before?
Yeah, I might. Balazs.
Balazs, welcome. Who are you with? I know, but I'm saying... host here.
Sure. So I'm working on for the Decentralized Identity Foundation for like the last couple of months, and I thought it would be a good time to maybe join one of Aries calls.
Well, welcome. We're glad to have you. And in a minute, we'll have an announcement about the ongoing progress with the DIDCOM working group in the DIF. So.
I don't have like a user for the Wiki, so I can't add myself. Just so if you could, someone could add me, that would be good.
Okay, I will in a minute if that hasn't happened already. Linux Foundation account is what's required to access the Wiki. Announcements. We have the Connectathon happening next week in Provo, Utah. We're grateful to StreetCred and Hyperledger, and have to thank Daryl and CU Ledger for also sponsoring food, which we very much appreciate. There is room if you're willing to sponsor some lunch or some breakfast or some other things, that snacks during, that would be very helpful. Please RSVP. That will help us to know who's coming. Friday is considered the cutoff so that we can try and handle logistical things. So we can still come, but please, if at all possible, let us know by Friday so that we can get counts recorded and all of those things. We will, these calls span both of the morning and the U.S., morning and the U.S. afternoon calls for the Aries Working Group, and we will be having both of those calls from the Connectathon. And so we will also be trying our best to include Zoom calls or other things that we can message out on Rocket Chat so that the people can dial in if you're not able to be there in person. And we'll have more as we get a lot closer next week. We've been announcing the webinar on Pure DIDs. That was excellent. Daniel Hardman did a fantastic job. And I have a link to the recording here if you want to go listen to that. Oftentimes recordings are nice because you can play them at faster than real time and ingest the information at a nice rate. We also have an edX course that includes Indies, Aries, and Ursa that's now online. Related meetings review. Last week was the Indie Contributors call, and that's where we covered a whole lot of these meetings. We did not have an Aries working group call this morning, and so there's nothing, of course, to report on there. That will happen next week. That's every other week. Is there anything else for related meetings that we should bring up? Again, we're covering these a little bit less, but you're welcome to drop meetings or notes in the Wiki if you would like other people to have links or to be aware of things, but we'll spend a little bit less time covering them in the call. Okay, on to work updates. Aries KMS? Any news there? Any work on verifiable data registry interface? Cloud Agent Python?
Nothing much to talk about. We're still working on lots of things, and 0.4 is likely to be breaking changes, but nothing has been released recently.
Okay. Aries Framework Go. Troy, you're typing.
Sorry, it's just caught me.
No, you're good.
The weekly notes post as usual. I mentioned this last week that we're focusing a lot on the fundamental protocols where we're doing the working on routing, WebSocket, Transport, WASM, etc. I thought it would be helpful to note that there's a few of the Framework Go contributors that have work in progress RFCs going on. So there's work on actually posting an RFC for the JWE compliant envelope. There was an early draft of data authorization posted, and there's a work in progress on writing an RFC about transporting other protocols on top of DIBCOM, so DIBCOM tunnels. So I'll mention this in the chat when there's something posted.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for adding the notes too, Troy. That's really helpful for those catching up during the meeting and after. Jack, any update on Aries SDK Ruby?
No, not this week, sorry.
Okay. I'm going to, can I clean this up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Any updates from the .NET framework?
I noticed Tomislav's not here, so I will note that I believe he's been working on support for the 1.0 credential exchange. So, and I think his plan is to transition it, just not support both, but just transition from 0.1 to 1.0.
Awesome. Good to hear ongoing work there. Static Agent Python.
I did push out another release, and I'll drop a link to the release notes.
Awesome. Toolbox is part of the topics, and so I'm going to skip that for now. The repos have been moved, and I'll cover that briefly when we talk about that. And then Aries Framework Java. Aries SDK JavaScript. Okay, any rich schemas showed up in here twice, sort of. Maybe not. That was just a verifiable registry interface. Never mind, different work. Any update on the rich schemas or verifiable credentials? I know on the agenda today we have some Zmix Anon Creds 2 topics from Lavesh. Any other updates? All right, any libindy migration notes? Ursa notes? Okay, I think we've made it through in record time. Grateful for everyone doing work and sharing and being part of the community. It helps a whole lot and helps move things forward. So we're grateful for the work that you do. Next on the agenda, Mr. Stephen Curran is gonna run the issue game. Let me stop sharing so that you can have the screen there.
By the way, while you're getting ready, I love that we do this game, and I love that we're getting things closed out. Thank you for doing it.
Credit goes to Mr. Curran, who started it, and I'm continuing an excellent idea.
And I just unmuted because I said all sorts of good things. You guys can see that, I trust?
Yep, we can.
Okay, so I picked four issues, went down from the top and thought of four, you know, in order of most recent that I thought we could close. So we'll start with 262, which is about the issuance protocol, credential issue. It started with a question from Evernim. I think somebody at Evernim talking about confusion as to where you can start. So notice in this that a holder can start from send proposed credential or start from send credential request. And the issue was, you know, is that realistic? Can that be done? in an indie perspective. So the basic answer was basically no, you can't go from credential request as the initiating message from a holder if you're using indie, but for other models you could, which is why this is presented this way. Got to a subsequent question, does indie require the message offer credential today? And I believe the answer is yes, it does. And so offer credential must be sent in the current indie model. So again, if you're using ZKPs, using indie, you have to start either with offer credential or propose credential from the holder as the way to proceed. I think those are the only issues. And so if anyone has any other comments, 262 is there. Is there anyone to add anything, or can we close this as I think it's resolved?
I'd be content to close it as long as we haven't imposed new requirements on either credential ecosystem. So like we're talking about indie credentials, the requirements are start with either an offer or a proposal. If we're talking about non-indie, you can start at any of those three positions, offer, propose, or a request, right? Is that
correct? Yes, that is what we're saying. Okay. I don't see anything when I was read through. I didn't see anything, and so I think it's good to close. Nobody objected. We're going to move on. I don't think that one's a very controversial one, so let's hopefully that's resolved. This was one that I think might have been between team members. I'm not sure, but I didn't see any reason to keep it open. So I'll just bring this up. I think this is both from SecureKey, and then Kyle added a question as a label, but I think it's the fact that there's an S here, but it's identified as a singleton, and so that's confusing. But having said that, the SIG decorator is going away anyway. It's defined as a signal. I don't think there's anything of value in keeping this open any further. We good with that?
I agree.
Okay.
I agree. I think so too.
Okay, good. All right. Two down. Okay, this one was a little more, had a lot of discussion on it, and we didn't get any final resolution, but so here's the nub of the issue. In a number of places, such as 56 and 23, we reference a VAR key, a public key. And there was a proposal to use the did key method, which calling it a method is kind of interesting, but we'll go with that, as the method. So we would, so the did key method, if people aren't aware of it, it transforms a public key into a did with did colon key colon, and then the public key after it as the did ID. It uses, it's not referenced, but it uses the multicodex, which is referenced over here. The multicodex put a short string in the front of the var key to say, this is the type of key it is, which can be looked up in a registry. So that instead of just saying this is the var key and the protocol and the participants in the protocol having to know what algorithm is being used, this prefix on the var key will tell you what algorithm is being used. So that is a concise way of including that additional information. What did key then does after that is it quote unquote resolves it, but really all it does is transform the public key and the type information that you get back from resolving the multicodex piece and define and puts substitutes in, transforms that into a did doc And that DidDoc has a defined layout, and you're basically doing search and replace on the various places to stick in the elements of that you've resolved using multi-codecs. A con of that, a pro is that it's a DidDoc. The con of it is it has lots of baggage to it. It was defined by folks that are very interested in capabilities model and things. So it's got a bunch of things that are related to capabilities. Basically, there's a lot of stuff in it that we would not use. It does allow DID resolution mechanisms. So you can reference in the DID specific keys within the DID doc. Obviously, there is only one key because this isn't actually a DID, it's a key. And another pro is that there is a move to standardize that DID doc or that DID key method. So those are the things. As I say, it's not a DID in that it doesn't exist on a ledger. You can't rotate the key because the key is the DID, and things like that. So it definitely should not be confused with DID peer, which also does not go on a ledger, but has all of the attributes basically of a normal DID. A second proposal that was put forth in the same one was instead of just having a naked var key in here, and instead of going to DID key, do add the multi-codecs piece so that we get both a public key and a type. And then a pro of that is the key remains just a key. It's just we get more information from it. We have essentially versioning multi-key or multi-algorithm support and versioning embedded in it because multi-codecs comes with that. And then, of course, the other proposal is do nothing. So there are your sort of three pieces to it. There was a lot of discussion on it. So if you're interested in this type of thing, there's lots and lots of comments made by lots of smart people. 38 comments going in. So there's lots of things to read about it. But I think anyone else want to say anything, but I think I've captured what are the key points in the discussion. Anyone want to jump in now?
I would just like to express the opinion that the con at the bottom of the left column is a big deal. The thing we're trying to represent is a key, not a DID. So transforming it to a DID, even though it's a DID that happens to represent a key, feels to me like a mistake, for what it's worth.
Similar opinion, but you used better words than I would have chosen.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with what you're saying there, Daniel, except then the alternative proposal, one of the cons I would say in the alternative proposal is we have to create a whole new identifier and probably create the appropriate documentation for a completely new type of identifier, which is a key identifier, which traps the multi-codec behavior and documents it sufficiently so that people have all the answered questions around it. Like it's a whole new identifier. As a new identifier, we would need a suitably defined key identifier in its own right.
But wouldn't multi-codecs itself be just that representation? All we do is put the prefix on this and we're done?
Well, you still have to define all of the nuances of that appropriately. Do you want a human readable element in front of that? Because is this key going to be used anywhere where it needs some form of human readable element to it? Or are we just going to say it's multi-codec and leave it kind of largely undefined or kind of incomplete in that capacity?
So my con to that one, Tobias, is DID key defines a whole bunch of stuff that we would be telling developers, oh, just ignore that stuff because we don't use it. In DIDCOM, there isn't a need for all of the other pieces that are defined within the DID doc that they're trying to, you know, that has been proposed as DID key. If you look at the DID key method itself and come down and look at the DID, here's the key, and this is just the codec, multi-codec piece. So it's the var key with the prefix on it. But this is what the key expands to. And basically what you see is everywhere you see ID did key, it's just the ID. Here you're seeing what the type is, so that's pulled from the multidex. These just reference back to the public key. So all of them just use the same key, same algorithm, everything else. So I don't know, basically we've got to say, oh yeah, just don't worry about the assertion method and don't worry about the capability and don't worry about the invocation. So that's my problem with it.
So I would just like to point out that the only things you're probably not going to use in DIDPOM right now is the capability invocation delegation. The authentication, assertion method, key agreement, and public key sections are probably quite relevant because key agreement being explicit about that, that's doing a conversion of the Edwards curve to a explicit key agreement type, something that we have kind of a murky definition of in terms of how we establish key agreement in DIDCOM. The authentication section basically denotes that that key is capable of being used in an authentication context, which, you know, is being explicit about the key's purpose, and the assertion method is required for signing verifiable credentials. So I do agree with you that we need to be cautious about the baggage we do take on. I am wary of the fact that if we define our own key identifier, we need to suitably define the rules around passing it, what a multi-codec key put into some form of processor yields as a result, and how it is suitably used, which keys are defined, and that sort of stuff. So I'm not advocating that we absolutely have to use DID key, but I'm just making us aware that if we decide to just use the multi-codec identifier, we need to appropriately define an alternative identifier syntax and define it sufficiently so that we answer and satisfy enough of our questions in reference to DIDCOM.
Okay, that's interesting. And one thing I didn't realize is, and I saw this as I presented this and hadn't noticed it, was this transformation to the different curves, basically, right? That's what that's what this represents.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Thanks.
Daniel, you've tried to speak a couple times.
Yeah, I don't think we can close this one. What you're saying, Tobias, I think is true, that there are semantics that we need, but I don't think they map onto the methods that you identified. I don't think we need assertion method and that other stuff, because the recipient keys array that we're talking about here isn't used for those things. I think if you want a better alternate proposal, we could propose using JWKs. That would give us something that we're not inventing ourselves, but it would have none of the baggage of a DID.
I was going to bring up that question and ask how JWKs fit in here, because I knew that was part of the discussion. The short answer is in light of discussing this whole thing right here, I think we can't close this, but we should probably try and redirect some attention to this to try and further the conversation.
So before we defer this to next week and we're all in person, does anyone who hasn't contributed to the discussion have anything to add to it? The discussion in the issue itself, in issue 201. All right. So the answer there is we do have to make sure the alternate of a JWK is in there, and I'm not sure it is. I don't really recall. I didn't read everything yesterday, but I don't recall seeing that. And then we leave it open. But I personally think we should try to resolve this. And so I think this could be a topic for next week. Do we have time? How are we doing on time?
We're about there. Depends on how fast you think this might be.
Maybe this is one as an introduction for next week. I don't think we can necessarily resolve this. This was something that Sam raised recently, strategy for trouble-free string migration. So basically, we have a couple of issues that require replacing, essentially replacing strings. And for backwards compatibility, what do we do about that? How do we manage that? So one example, the easiest one to know is the one that where we're switching from message types being did solve and then a magic string that was defined a long time ago into being https://didcom.org or something like that. So that will come. And so what will happen is two agents will be talking. One of them will use the old method. One of them will use the new. And of course, they won't be able to interoperate. And so the question is, how do we do the backwards compatibility on these? And we've had a couple of suggestions that we go low coordination and a couple high coordination. Complex but low coordination, and the other is simple and high coordination. A couple of people have voted for the simple. My vote is for the complex, just because coordination is complex, and it's actually even more complex than coding. So in issues like this, I don't think these will be the last two that will come along. I think we're going to have this issue come up again and again. And I think for as soon as we expand the number of agents that are wanting to interoperate, this will become a significant problem. Floor is open.
Isn't the answer going to depend a little bit on what people are willing to do? I'll do whatever the consensus opinion is, but I want to know if there is a consensus opinion or if we're all over the map.
Well, I mean, this PR was this issue was raised to see if there's any consensus. Obviously, on specific issues, and anyone who's implementing an agent can choose to do whatever they want. But I think what we're trying to get is just, we would recommend doing it this way or that way.
Okay.
I will tell you that I'm spending a bunch of my time trying to coordinate between different parties as things change, so that we can get things to stay working even as things change. So that's why the low coordination model works best for me, my experience.
I don't need to know that we need to resolve this. The thing that I'll point out is that you actually have some coordination in either case. It's not no coordination, it's just low. It really is a matter of expectation. I think the important thing is that we more or less agree on one model or another model, and then make sure that we fully embrace it. We don't have to, but I think that we'll get along better as a community if we do. For example, if we're talking about converting the core protocols from a DID URI to an HTTP URI, then getting proactive about setting those dates in the community, et cetera, will help us to make the required process. What isn't helpful is what we're doing right now, which is kind of not talking about it and not making any progress.
Well, my understanding on that was we had some work to be done ahead of that. Did we not, or not? Is that not right?
We had some website stuff to be set up, but there isn't any reason we can't actually convert to something before there's anything to resolve to. We're not resolving it right now.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
So kind of not really, but and we kind of haven't really done anything about it. And I think, why don't we pick this up next week and we can
opinions. That's why I raised it as a plan to raise it. One of the other things though that we found in working on this is we're restructuring code to make it easier to do these things. So you realize, oh, we're going to have to do this. And if the default behavior is automatically, well, on, such and such a date, we're going to switch over, and we expect all our partners to switch over, the high coordination one, I think that's going to be really hard. Well, what is helpful is if you start to see the patterns of what's going to change, you adjust some of the code to make it easier to do those changes. So for example, we're redoing how we're managing connections a little to be independent of the protocol so that when we go from connections to data exchange, we can support both at the same time, which is ideally the right thing to do.
Yes, in that case, I agree with you, but there's other cases where it just makes it a lot more complex on how to do things and the coordination within your code base. Let's continue this next week, though. This is a really good intro to the topic and one of the things that we need to, I think, address sooner rather than later.
Okay.
Thank you for running the issue game, Stephen. We're grateful for the work here. It is nice to bring up these issues and make progress on them. Next up on the agenda, I believe, is me, and I am previewing I'm talking about the DIDCOM diff working group. A lot of work has gone into trying to work out the right IPR protected location to have ongoing conversations about the ongoing DIDCOM work that we want to have in a broader sense. What is happening is that the DIF steering committee has approved a DIDCOM working group that does not require normal membership to participate in the same way. It's a little bit complicated for IPR reasons, but there are two ways. If you are an individual and not representing a company, then the process is easy. There's a contributor agreement or a contributor feedback agreement, I think it's called, to sign that is quite easy to do. If you're part of a company, then in representing a company in the work, then there is the process is a little bit different for necessary legal reasons. But the short answer is that any contributors or people who want to be involved in that process will be able to have that resolved with no membership fee. At the outset of this, the DIF is also considering goals and mission and everything else, which affects what membership in the DIF actually means and everything else. But for the effect of the DIDCOM working group, it will still be open, and those things can be resolved. So right now, the end of this week and the beginning or the next week is the process of refining a working group charter. And choosing chairs, typically two co-chairs to run meetings and help manage the working group. And so that's going on right now. The link that I have in here is a link to the mailing list for that new working group that has already been created. And you can go ahead and apply there. The model of the mailing group will be anyone can read it, but to post it, you will need to, because of the IPR reasons, you will need to be authorized to post. And that helps clean up some of the IPR things that are going on. In the same model, I believe will be all the way through the meetings, you'll be able to listen or watch a recording with no problems, but any contributions need to make sure that we are IPR protected and legal agreements are in place for that. And so that's going on. We anticipate the first meeting, which will be a beginning coordination, kind of a kickoff meeting that will not get into technical topics, but will handle the startup of all of those other issues. Will happen next week, but the week after. So the week following the Connectathon, and then with regular meetings, continuing thereafter. Are there any questions or comments about this?
Yeah, I'd just like to jump in and say a huge thanks to you, Sam, and the rest that have worked behind the scenes. I know this has been an incredibly complicated process due to several factors. So personally, and I think I speak a lot for a lot of the community, thanks for all your effort on this.
You're all welcome. You can pay me back by being involved and help us push forward the work. That's what will make it all worth it.
So I was planning to just leave it now.
Kyle, come on.
Sam, Drummond? Question. So this came up on another call I was on earlier today. This is only a subset of the Hyperledger RFC, Aries RFCs, right?
That's correct.
And so how does that subset get determined, and what are the mechanics for how they actually will start becoming DIDCOM working group RFCs?
The scope will be initial discussions of the working group. The intent is that the original discussions will be centered around the encryption envelope, which is of course important. There are related issues to that, and we'll be talking about what really needs to be involved in the initial round of that. The process here is that this larger working group is starting from work that has been incubated inside of Ares, and so the RFCs will remain in the, as they are now, will remain in the Ares RFC repository, but we anticipate that they will be retired as there are new things that we, the Ares community, seek to support as the output of that other group. So none of the RFCs are leaving the Ares repositories, but the future work will happen in the DIDCOM working group at the DIF. And we anticipate using the output as the foundation of the stuff that we build here as it becomes available. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. A follow-on question that I think is pretty clear, but implementations of those RFCs, that code could live anywhere, yeah?
Yes. And it's not inappropriate for implementations. Of course, we'll have to, you know, Ares code bases will have to have support for those things. We have support for what we have now. And as we, you know, move to sort of next versions of things, you know, as produced by that group, we'll still need working code. And so there, you know, there may emerge sort of standardized libraries that are available for use. Of course, none of those are required. And it's important that the protocol not require use of a single code base. And I don't think that's really a controversial point of view at this point. So yes, Ares repositories will continue to contain code that helps Ares code bases support the necessary protocols.
Cool.
Other questions?
I thought the first part of that about RFCs either staying or moving was confusing. So hopefully that gets a little more. It doesn't sound like a good idea to have multiple parallel ones at the same time. So, and I certainly heard stories that we would be moving RFCs, you know, just moving them over, which I think is reasonable. While they're, you know, once they are being discussed in DIF, once there's, you know, serious motion on them, I wouldn't want to move too many ahead of time so we can keep having discussions in Ares around those.
Agree on the not too many ahead of time. There's not a desire to have parallel efforts. What I'm talking about is the physical documents will not cease to exist within the Ares repository. The RFC flow includes retiring RFCs, so that they are there for historical purposes, but not actively being worked on or improved. And that's what I meant by the fact that they will still exist within the Ares repositories. So there's not a goal to have a parallel effort here in the Ares working group on the same topics that are actively being talked about in the DIDCOM working group. That's not what I intended to mean. The work will definitely be happening there, but we're not going to delete the documents, if you will, out of the Ares repository. We will similarly mark them up with a header or a status note at the top that indicates that, you know, future work is happening, and here's a link to where it's going. But the new documents, if you will, RFCs or whatever the group decides is the necessary output will be worked on in that working group. So please go add yourself to the mailing list, and that is the absolutely easiest way for us to notify everyone who's interested to help them be aware of what's going on. So that's the easiest way to make that happen. We will likely be, notifying the community or sort of reporting on a similar meeting the way we do other similar meetings. because of the high relevance to the Aries work. And so if you can't make all of those, you know, and I believe those will be recorded and posted. If you can't make all of those, you know, there will be efforts to sort of keep everyone in sync, but it is incredibly important that anyone who wants to be involved in sort of forming the future of DIDCOM is available, you know, tries to be as involved as you can. Okay. We're slightly over time on that topic. Any other final questions that need to be answered?
Just a quick suggestion is to keep momentum going on these, it might be a good idea to take some of the time we use here and switch that to just be called a DIF meeting instead of an Aries meeting, but continue on with the same, you know, ideally with as much the same people contributing and moving forward. So as we transition.
Maybe there's some IPR reasons why that's difficult to do. Because we don't have mechanisms, nor do we want to install mechanisms to maintain the IPR protectedness of those topics, which means it's likely going to be a different call for IPR reasons.
But at the same time.
Oh, you mean exactly. The same call slot?
Yes.
That's a possibility. We haven't discussed when the call will actually be, and that is a strategy that we can approach. It is my observation that we have not been devoting much call time to these issues specifically over the last couple of months, and that we're not really running out of topics to talk about. And so I don't really want to limit the number of time to talk about other issues within the Aries community. And so an additional call might be helpful. But that is up for discussion, and that will happen on the mailing list and in the initial meetings for that working group. Okay. Moving on, by the way, one of the topics that Reuven has suggested that we might be able to talk about at the Connectathon is reviewing the proposed charter. And so that might be one of the activities that we can spend some time doing at the Connectathon, is to help verify that the charter of the working group is as we think appropriate as contributors to that work. That will come up there.
Oh, sorry, Sam. I've also got some concepts and kind of some thoughts in and around this move that I'd like to socialize, and if we get an opportunity to connect with on and get some feedback on.
I definitely think we'll have time. It's an important topic of the community, so that's a really good time for that. Okay, I'm going to switch gears. And talk about the toolbox and the Akamai toolbox plugin. They are now in Hyperledger repositories with the code and the stuff here. And let me explain a little bit about what these are. We've shown the toolbox before, and then the Akamai plugin for the Aries toolbox enables a set of protocols that allow for sort of one-off administrative type of operations with the toolbox. And I'll give an example of what that means. One of the useful things that we've done is there's actually two Docker Compose files within the toolbox repo, which will help you boot up a copy of Akamai with the plugin installed. You don't have to start here. There is a Python package. There's a way to install the plugin with pip out of GitHub. And then run that. So if you already have a running Akamai instance, this is something that you can pull out and add, and then these additional features will become available for you. It's worth noting that the toolbox itself has a number of features that are supported sort of natively, and that it will still work with Akamai, but there's some extended administrative features that this enables. I've got a quick demo here. The Docker Compose Alice Bob actually starts up two Akamai agents, and we've wired it up so that it uses ngrok automatically to provide. So this is running on Docker containers on my local system, but the invitation URL that it uses is automatically wired to move through ngrok, which is really, really helpful, because if you're sitting next to someone or you can show the URL not on your own local machine, and it helps connect in for demos and training and such. So if I copy the, you know, a URL and I add it, then I can end up with a connection to each of these agents. And then I can open up a window for each of them. And then that will connect to these agents that we're running here. And And you can do some interesting things. One of the things that it does is it runs the feature discovery protocol to discover which protocols are actually supported. And each of the modules within the toolbox will automatically show or hide itself depending on the presence of the supported protocols, which means that you can connect the toolbox and it will sort of automatically adapt to the supported feature, you know, the supported protocols of that agent that you're connecting to. Because we've installed the plugin, there's some extra protocols, for example, for invitations that allow for the creation of things. Like if I want to create an invitation here, this is the label that's going through here. I can create a new invitation, and that will be here. I can display the QR code, or I can copy the URL, and then over here I can consume an invitation, and now I've just, it'll move from pending to active in a second because of the settings that we have. It will, now we actually have a connection between Alice and Bob using that multi-use invitation. You'll notice that, of course, I've said this before, this is not intended to be an end user application in the sense of my mother. It's intended to be used for developers and sysadmins that might want to do things. It's really helpful, for example, if I really do need to come and create a multi-use invitation that's going to hang around for a while, it's nice to be able to use a utility to help me create and manage that. And so that's where it's going. That's about it for the demo. But the one of the things that I will mention is that the protocols that we enable in the toolbox need some review to be more generalized. And so we plan anyone could implement the same actual protocols with an agent besides Akapai, of course, and it would be automatically supported. We do plan to review those to make them as general as possible, and we'll have some review there. So that's the ongoing work that we'll be doing with the toolbox and the associated plugin in those particular areas. One thing that we're working on adding to the toolbox right now, it uses HTTP endpoints with return routing in order to get data back, messages back from the agent, since there's no inbound route to the toolbox itself. We have some work that should shortly enable the use of WebSockets if supported by Akapai in order to allow that to happen as well, which is more efficient and useful for a couple of reasons. So that's some work that's nearly done. Any quick questions on the toolbox or the plugin? Awesome. We welcome contributions to the toolbox. If there's a protocol that you would like to use it for a utility or anything else, then those are there and available for contribution. Of course, they're youngish projects. So if you discover things that ought to be fixed, you can open issues or send PRs or anything else, and that will help us move the project forward. And with that, I'm done. Daniel Bloom is up next, talking about the pluggable back channels in the test suite. Let me stop sharing.
Yeah, so I will share my screen real fast. Are we seeing things?
Yes, we're seeing things.
Okay, great. So just to give a little bit of background and hopefully to orient everybody to the terminology, so we're talking about the test suite, first of all, and the test suite communicates with the agent under test through a air quote front channels, and that's where the protocols and the messages being sent and received are validated and making sure that the agent under test is conforming to the protocol. But we've also got a back channel, which helps facilitate the setup or continuation inside of a given protocol, and it's a very necessary part of having a consistent testing environment for your protocols. So previously, we had talked about backchannel in a couple of ways. Early on, we were thinking like super simple, as basic as possible, and then each implementation could plug into that super simple mechanism or do their own thing or whatever. And then we kind of swung the other way and we were intending that back channel to itself be a full on agent connection, and the actions of setting up the state or triggering actions inside of the agent under test were actual full on agent messages being sent and received over that specific connection with a predefined identity, defining the keys. So after working on the test suite over the past little while, it struck me that it might be a good idea to try to find a happy medium between what we had thought before and what we were kind of approaching, and kind of just let back channels be pluggable. Meaning if you want to have your back channel be operated over a full-on agent connection, you can do that. If you want to use a REST API similar to what ACPI provides, or other code bases are also going that direction, your back channel could use those already available functions of your agent to facilitate testing. So this is currently a proposal. It's not necessarily accepted into the test suite yet, but I feel it's a good idea. It's, I think, pretty straightforward and will be helpful in keeping tests concise, for one thing, since we won't need to split it up between different flows and how the back channel might work. But in general, it just makes it a lot less effort for the agent developers in order to integrate with the test suite, I think. So just to demonstrate what that actually looks like, so the back channel in the test suite is defined as an abstract base class in Python, which is essentially just defining the interface for the back channel. And how I've kind of got this thinking arranged right now is that there's a core set of back channel methods, specifically a setup, reset, new connection. And then each protocol that is being tested also has its own sort of back channel abstract base class, which defines the methods it needs in order to complete those protocols in an automated or otherwise fashion, I suppose. And then each agent implementation or agent implementations, which have similar backend style management setups, such as the REST API that is becoming kind of common, can use a back channel, can define a back channel that uses, I don't know, what the request library of Python in order to implement these methods. So in addition to defining the interfaces inside of the test suite, I've also included a back channel, which does each of these things just manually. It's the copying and pasting from the terminal. This is not too dissimilar from how the indie agent test suite worked before, as we used it during the last Connectathon. And it just shows basically what it would look like for someone to write a new back channel and then plug it into the test suite. So I think that's about all I have to say about that. It's currently a proposal. If you feel like this is a bad idea, I'd like to hear about it. But unless somebody comes up and says something really thinks it's an awful idea, I think we'll probably continue with this, and hopefully we can get some back channels going and working for agent implementations that will enable us to have more automated testing. Even before the Connectathon would be fantastic. So on that note, any questions?
Doesn't this mean that every development team that brings an agent under test has to write their own back channel?
So if you conform to what another back channel which already exists is doing, such as the REST API, if you happen to want to conform to that same interface on your own agent anyways, you can just use the same back channel as ACPI in testing. And we can easily collect those back channels and include them in the test suite by default as well, I think.
Okay, but it's not just if you're using REST, you'd have to use exactly the same REST API, all the same endpoints and all the same semantics and all the same payloads in order for the back channel to be useful.
Yes. So you've got some choices. You can either write your, write your own totally custom back channel from the ground up, or you can support one of the interfaces already, you know, managed by another interface to do it. You're going to have to write some custom stuff either way. The goal is not that we require that every agent developer creates their own back channel. But the goal is to allow multiple paradigms to exist from a back channel concept. So hopefully we have fewer of these rather than more of these, but the right answer has turned out to not be one.
Okay, but and so we're basically paying attention to the rest-based control and ignoring the others. So everybody who doesn't have an agent controllable by rest has a new burden, and everybody who does have an agent controllable by rest gets off easy.
No, that's not what we're saying. There is no back channel.
That's exactly what this amounts to, Sam. I'm going to have to do exactly the same thing again for connect.me because it doesn't have a restful interface, because connect.me is controlled by push notifications. I'm going to have to do all the work to retrofit this to the test suite the same way as happened with the last.
So I'd like to point out that this was actually inspired by work that was done by Artem Ivanov, who is working on integrating VCX with the test suite. He put together a very simple HTTP mechanism for VCX in order to create an automated testing environment that VCX would work under. That wasn't really something that I could easily adopt into the test suite since it was only specific to VCX, but having a back channel mechanism that he could very simply plug into, it's not very complicated to define these interfaces, I think, or to define your back channel with this structure. He could very easily adapt the work he's already done for VCX, for instance, to this mechanism.
So our independently and in pretty much in parallel to this, we came up with the same conclusion that no matter what, every agent is pretty much going to have to write some sort of way to communicate with the test suite. So we think this idea is pretty solid. I don't see any other way around it. Like, I don't know how you can have meaningful tests if you don't have a way to say, hey, agent, get ready for this test. I think it's necessary.
I certainly don't think it requires that agents implement a REST interface. Like if what is the most sense for your agent implementation is to have the back channel be done over as the interrupt test suite RFC defines, with it being an actual agent connection with a specific testing protocol or something of that nature, then that is totally acceptable and something that I think we can do without too much trouble.
That one, Daniel, I think is my preferred. And it is an option and will continue to work for anyone that wants to implement that interface. But teams can now choose whether they want to implement the same sort of back channel interface or if they want to do something else and still be able to integrate it with the test suite. I'm sure this will be an active topic at the Connectathon, and moving forward on this and helping us to sort of clarify the ideas and figure out the right way to do this going forward, I think will be a valuable use of our time there.
So it contradicts the RFC about the test suite.
It allows for the RFC about the test suite.
No, the test suite says that the back channel did come over HTTP.
And that can still be true. But it allows for alternative back channels.
Either submit a change to the RFC language or don't claim that they're in harmony.
I would be happy to submit a change to that language.
You've again ignored a test suite RFC that was written and gone and done something else and then claimed it was compatible. It's not.
I don't feel like I should apologize for accepting the coding advice of your own team member, Daniel. But let's continue to talk about this and work this out. We'll get them to align, and we can figure out the right thing to do either way. This is not a goal to be divisive. The goal here is to produce the simplest possible thing we can to serve what the community actually needs. So this is a proposal, and if you think this is a terrible idea, we'd love to hear why on the PR that exists on the protocol test suite. And if we need to do other work, then we can to align or refine the language in the test suite RFC, then we can do that. Robert asked a question, does it mean that back channels are optional? They are optional if you're willing to go through a completely manual testing process. If you would like an automated test, which is of course desired, then a back channel is required.
This is Daryl. I'll weigh in. I think this is a really important thing. It's actually something along the lines of what we've been actually looking at building. As you know, you probably know we work tightly with Evernote. We've got a combination of customers that use ConnectMe, some that are more moving towards an embedded SDK. But one of the things that we need to test out, and it's a combination of CLEDGER and Evernim, is proving that we're able to handle a certain number of wallets on the far end with a certain amount of volume of activity. This wallet is a headless one. I like it. I think it's great.
As I said as well, I think the back channel can be optional, I suppose, but I would imagine that there's very few tests you're going to be able to run if you're not able to talk to your agent and get it set up to run. But we'll see how the tests evolve.
Any future comments or any comments on the same topic before we hand time over to Lavesh for his CMix? Okay, we will do that. Lavesh, are you ready?
Yes, I'll share my screen.
Yep, go ahead, thanks.
So this is about the ZMix, which is a toolkit to create proofs and for the verifiers to request proofs. Now, this is only relevant to a non-Quest 2.0. So if you are looking for non-ZKP credentials, this won't make sense. And if you're like still wondering about a non-Quest 1.0, again, doesn't make sense. This is irrelevant to that. Okay. So and this is different from a proof request. So ZMix comes to the cryptographic layer, which means it's not concerned about fetching keys from the ledger or picking things from the wallet. It assumes the things are given to it. So if you fetch key from somewhere else, like a ledger or somewhere else, you give it to it. If you have some, let's say, signature or some secret data, you will give that to ZMix. So ZMix will not interact with the wallet. So it won't interact with any outside database or your wallet or whatever. Okay. So you can think of it as a language to create proofs and request proofs. Okay, so let's look at some basic entities that we have here. It's an RFC. It's sort of merged RFC. The technical details of the code, I'll say a POC deviates from this RFC, but the concepts are same. So what we have are three kinds of, on a high level, three kinds of objects: proof, spec, witness, and proof. So proof spec is something that defines what you want to prove. So let's say, as an example, if you want to prove that you have certain credential and you have one more credential, you have some attributes of credential satisfy some predicate. So that all will be part of proof spec. Witness is the secret data. So the signature that you have from the issuer, the holder has from issuer, or anything else that is secret that's known only to the prover is contained in the witness. And proof is something that is created by prover and sent to the verifier to verify it. Okay. Now let's look at a higher level, how this flow would be. Like, let's look at how a proof spec is. A proof spec is a collection of statements. I think I missed that. Okay. A proof spec is a collection of statements. A statement is, can be something that you want to prove. So one statement can be proof that you have certain credentials. Other statement can be proof that certain attribute has satisfies certain predicate, right? Or a predicate can be a range proof, or it can be a set membership proof, or whatever. So a proof spec is a collection of statements. So a statement is defined as an enum, right? So you have a signature BBS, so prove that you have a BBS plus signature, prove that you have a PS signature, prove that some Pedersen commitment has certain property, or maybe you know the message contained in that, prove that certain message satisfies certain interval, right? So the statement is the enum, it passes these types. So a proof spec, once a proof spec is created with certain statements, it's sent to the prover. The prover creates, or let's say, collects all the witness that information that he needs to collect. So for each statement, he might have a witness. Sometimes he doesn't have a witness. We see in the code why it doesn't have a witness, but he'll collect relevant witnesses, right? So a witness, again, is a collection of statement witness, which corresponds to, so you can see that each statement witness is an enum, which corresponds to a BBS plus or PS or whatever that is. So like whatever, collect the witness that you have, and then use that to create the proof. And the proof that you give, is, again, is a collection of statement proof. So it's proof for each statement, right? Because you're proving several statements, and those several statements can be, might involve different data, might be using different techniques or whatever. So you give a proof corresponding to each statement that you are asked to prove. So again, it's a bunch of statement proofs. And a statement proof can again be whatever the type of statement proof is, right? That's the high level idea of that. And now I'll just go on to a test and show how the API is, and then I'll just walk you through if you want to know like what it's inside, what it's doing inside. Okay, so just go through a simple test. That the scenario of the test is that you have a like two credentials, right? One is a different kind of signature, other is a different kind of signature, and you're proving that you have these two credentials, and you're also revealing certain attributes from the credential. So what we call selective disclosure, really. Okay, so this is a boilerplate stuff. So, or let's say setup stuff where the holder got a signature and the signature is verifiable and blah blah. Okay, and now the verifier starts creating this proof spec. So you're asking for this first signature, you're asking the prover to reveal messages indices 1, 3, and 4. So I know we in the schema we have names for attributes, but for the crypto, it's there is no name for the attribute, or the messages. The attributes are just an array of, the attributes are just an array. So each credential you can think of having two things. One is a signature, and the other is the array of attributes. And each, because it's an array, you can reference each attribute by its index. So that's what this is saying, that for PS signature, for this first credential, reveal attributes 1, 3, and 4, and they should be some value. And later on, we can decide if you want to make this optional, but basically it's asking that, you know, reveal them and they should be equal. So it's like saying, prove from your credential that your name is Alice and your city is New York and something else. Similarly, it's asking this other reveal message clause for revealing certain messages from another signature, the BBS plus signature, right? So it's looking over two credentials. Okay, now here, verify creates a statement. It's POK. I know in the RFC, like it's not that terms are not correct. So the code is using more accurate terms. It's POK for proof of knowledge. So POK signature PS, right? Proof of knowledge of signature PS. And you create a statement. You see the statement contains all the public data. So it has the public key. Params, again, you can think of both of them as public key. They can be, this can be different from for different type of signatures, but this is, again, public data. Reveal message, again, is public. There's not like you're asking the holder to reveal certain messages. Same for BBS plus. So again, it has just one, there's no params. Again, these are like implementation details. So different signatures might have different kind of public data. And you pass the reveal messages. You create a proofs. And when I say you, mean the verifier here. So verifier again, creating this proof spec, creates the empty proof spec as these two statements. And now the prover's part starts over here. It's, gets these witnesses from the wallet or wherever he gets them, creates these witness objects, populates this hash map. It was a vector in the RFC. It's a hash map here because that's what makes sense for the implementation. The RFC was written at a time when there was no implementation. So it's the details are different there. Okay, and the prover just, so once he has the prover has accumulated all the witness data, it calls the create proof method, and he's passing the proof spec. The witness, which is a collection of all the witnesses, and some label. So this is just to generate, basically seed some transcript. So you can, this is not secret, this is public. So the verifier will have to do the same thing. So that's the API for the prover. So he calls create proof, and again you can create a trait around it or implement some, you know, pack it in some fancy object. But that's the idea. So the creating proof just takes this proof spec and witness and this label, and the proof is created, and the verify calls this verify proof method with this verify with this proof spec. The proof. So this is the same proof spec that the prover used, right? So it's public data and the proof and the same label that the prover used, but that will
so, you know, create a proof. Lovesh, can I ask some questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like I'm struggling to see the forest for the trees. In other words, I'm drowning in details here. Can you show an example of a proof spec that would be fed into zMix?
Yeah, that is a proof spec. So if
I'm
you
not
wanna...
talking about a data structure in code. I'm assuming that a proof spec is communicated by, like, is it some JSON or is it a string, or how would a proof spec be moved across a wire, not in Rust code?
A proof spec would be created from a proof request. So a proof request is sent, and however it is passed, so it can send a JSON, XML, or whatever the way it's sent, the code will generate the proof spec. So the proof spec is not really...
So the proof spec is a data structure. It only has meaning inside code.
Yes. This code is meant to be called by Indie AVs or Indie SDK or some. So this is not meant to be called by applications like ConnectMe or something to create proofs from credentials, because I there was no API to fetch thing like store credentials or get credentials from the wallet or get keys or verify the keys are correct and all that, all those things.
Okay. And does zMix support requests to disclose or only requests that are related to zero knowledge?
They are disclosed. So, but yes, it is zero knowledge. So if you're wondering of, I have an EDSA signature, can zMix say, yeah, show me the EDSA signature? No, zMix will not, because there is no zero knowledge proof there. You just reveal the signature.
So if I get a proof request that says, please disclose your first and last name and prove that your age is greater than 21.
Right.
The code that gets that, does it break that into two parts and say, okay, there's the part about disclosing the first and last name, I'll send that down to some library that does disclosure, and then the part about over 21, I generate a proof spec for zMix about that, or does it send all of it to zMix?
All of it to zMix. So this part happening here is selective disclosure. And range, I'll show you an example later below of range, but this is all handled by zMix.
Okay.
Okay, so like these POK signature PS, this was really the selective disclosure. If you kept this map as empty, like nothing would be disclosed, but you'll only prove that you have a certain signature. Okay, so this is, any more questions? I have more to show, so if you don't have, I can go on other things. Okay, no questions. All right, so now we've seen how you do sector disclosure, which happens now, and how you prove credentials. By the way, like right now, there's a limitation, I think, in the SDK or maybe Ursa also, that if you don't want to reveal anything and if you just want to prove possession of that you have a credential, you cannot do that. Well, you can do that with zMix. Okay, let's go to the next thing where we basically prove equality of attributes. So let's say right now we have this thing of, okay, prove that you have the link secret is same in all the credentials, right? But that's not the only thing. Maybe you want to prove that your name is same in the, let's say you have three credentials and you want to prove that your name is same in the first and second credential, where your name appears at index one in first credential and index five in second credential. But that's a detail that will be taken care of by the person calling the zMix API. But that's, let's say that's one. But maybe you're using three credentials, right? So there's no, the attribute is not supposed to be common across that. Currently, our on Creds 1, well, assuming that. So we'll walk through over a scenario where you have three signatures, 2PS, 1DDS+, and you prove that attribute 0, so index 0, is same in all credentials. Then attribute 1 of first PS is equal to attribute 2 of second PS, attribute 2 of first PS is equal to attribute 3 of third PS, and those kind of separate things, right? So you can see that you have one attribute that's same in all, then you have those different combinations. So for that, we saw two kinds of statements. They were like proof knowledge of signatures of PS or BBS plus. There's one more statement, which is called equality. So equality is declared like this. Okay, so before equality, let's go on to the concept of message ref. So message references, any statement can have certain message associated with it. So if for a signature statement, the messages would be whatever what was signed. Okay, and how you refer to a message was this whole, these are a bunch of statements. And when you're proving something, you need to refer, especially predicates, you need to refer to messages in separate statements. The way you refer to is by a tuple, basically, which is a message ref. It's a struct, but you can think of a tuple. The statement index is which statement you're referring to, the message index is which message you're referring to. So if you want to look at the second attribute of third statement, you will say 3 and 2 for message index, like 3 for statement index and 2 for that. Okay, so this equality statement is, what does it? It takes a set of message references. So let's say simple example, I have three signatures, so three statements for them. Excuse me. And then I want to prove that the zeroth attribute is equal in all three. So I'll pass this equality statement a set of three message references, right? It would be 00, 10, and 20. So statement index and message index. And it will ensure that those messages are equal. How it will do, we can go later if you're interested, but the idea is, so it looks like this. Okay, so you have, this is again, some setup spot. So this is the thing we are proving attributes as equal. You have these, you create these three statements. So here you're just proving that you have the signature or the credential, and now you start create and you append these to the proof spec, and now you start creating the equality. So you create the equality where attribute 0 is equal in all three. So you create a set, you insert, so it's 0 0, which means this statement and this message, like for 0 index of this statement, the message contained in this statement. Similarly, for this statement 1 corresponds to this statement, so 0th message, statement 2 corresponds to this, so 0th message. And then you add this equality as a in the proof spec as a statement, right? So you create a statement and add it to proof spec. Similarly, let's say you want to prove that attribute 1 of first PS sig is equal to attribute 2 of second PS sig. Okay, so first PS sig was statement number 0. For second PS sig was statement number 1. So you take the statement numbers, you're talking about attribute 1 here, and you're talking about attribute 2 over here. So it will, you create that equality and add it to add it as a second equality. So, and you can just go on, create all that, and it will take care of them inside. So just a minor detail, I think. So let's say if you had the sets of those equality sets were like this, right? So you have the first set as, let's say 0, 1, 1, 3. And second set is 1 3 2 4. So eventually these two sets will be combined, because really you're asking is prove that attribute this message is equal to this message, and then this message is equal to this message, but that proves that ensures that these are equal. So those details will be taken care of internally, but just want to make you aware of that. Okay, so you keep on over here, so you keep on giving these equalities, and
Can I ask another big context question? Mm-hmm. Is this code that you're showing us in the master branch of Ursa right now?
No, this is on my fork, and no.
How is it going to get into the master branch of Ursa?
So I'm going to create a PR for this one. This is a POC, and really I want to get an opinion of the from the developers, like how if the API feels right to them, like once I have the go ahead and whatever change you made, I'll make a PR.
Okay, and then
and it's public, so I can.
So once this gets into IRSA, then anybody who consumes IRSA would have the option, if they wanted, of doing zero knowledge proving, kind of independent of the whole indie ecosystem. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And one more thing to say, you don't have to use zmix to use the knowledge proofs. Like that's why I want to show this thing. If you, let's say you wanted to just prove that you have a knowledge of a signature, right? Let's go over an example where you had PS signature and you want to, don't want to use zmix at all. Well, the API will then somehow look like this. So let's, till now you have got the, till here you have got a signature. So that's how, that's where the proving really starts. So you have this reveal message indices, and then you'll call this object passing the messages and the all the text signature and reveal message and all that. Then it will generate a challenge for you. Then you call this function gen proof, which will give you a proof. And then the verifier will have to, again, take the proof and generate the same challenge as you do, and then call this verify proof. So this is the way if you were to not use zmix and just use the primitives directly. Zmix is supposed to abstract the details of those primitives and by providing you a declarative language. Hello?
Is there documentation for this, Lomesh?
Not very good. So the RFC that we have, it's not, the technical details are inaccurate. And I'll update them. I'm going to update them very soon. So.
And the RFC that you're talking about is an IRSA RFC, not an ARIES RFC, correct?
Right, right.
Okay.
But the reason for bringing this to the ARIES call was to know if the developers of ARIES will feel okay consuming this kind of IRSA API.
Yeah, that was, that. I wanted to make a quick question just to be clear. If I were to reuse this code, but not as a Rust library, more of a, if this zero knowledge proof were to be exposed through an FFI callable interface so that I can consume it from my Go framework, let's say, is all of this stuff going to be exposed through that interface? Or are there going to be, or some of these details are going to be hidden behind some higher level interface?
So I am not sure of the zmix interface. Like, I don't know if this will be exposed through FFI, but these primitives, they are definitely going to be exposed through FFI to you. But I can definitely go and ask IRSA folks if the zmix needs to be exposed as well. And I mean, it might depend on the interest people have. If people have enough interest in exposing this zmix to FFI, we might go and do it. Otherwise, we are definitely going to do the primitives to FFI anyway. Does that answer your question?
Well, you just said that we need to figure it out. That's my takeaway, right?
Yeah, I'm saying for zmix, we need to figure out that we should do it or not. And and one of the factors that will decide that we do it or not is whether people want it, right? So my question then to you would be, would you want the zmix to be exposed through FFI, or would you want just the raw primitives through FFI would be fine for you? When I say primitives, means these PSSIG and Bulletproof and BBS plus SIG and all that stuff.
Yeah, honestly, I cannot really answer that question at this point in time. Okay. I'm just looking at this at a high level in terms of ZKP functionality, and that's it. So yeah.
Okay, but I'll definitely go and ask this question. Any more questions? There's one more thing I wanted to show. If you don't have questions, I can go and show that too.
We're up against the end of our time limit, but if it's quick, then why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, just a small thing. So there's one more thing called self-attested claims, right? So let's say I want to attach some terms and conditions to a proof. Or maybe there's some metadata that a prover wants to attach to the proof. So I, let's say, create a proof and I'm attaching the statement that don't use this proof to, you know, by MO or something that the objective is that whoever's verifying the proof knows that the prover attached this data to the proof and that proof, the data is inseparable from the proof. So that is separated, the proof verification will fail. So if in case that your verifier is resharing the proof to an auditor or something, then the verifier should not be able to detach that the data, right? So that's something we call self-attested claims, which is another kind of statement where you just pass a bytes, some bytes to it, and then the bytes get basically they hashed into the challenge. So the same idea as Schnorr signatures, where you prove knowledge of a secret key and you know, hash the message inside it. So that's self-attested claim statement, and basically the way you do it is let's see if I can. Okay, and that's how you do it. So let's say in this example, I have two signatures and three self-attested claims. So I have the signatures. I create these two statements for signatures. I add that, and let's say the first self-attested claim is so this is a proof spec, right? I have this add the first statement. My first claim is my IP is this. Again, these are dummy claims. I'm not saying that you should make those claims. I'm just saying that's like one example. You add the you add this self-attested claim here. You add the second signature, and then your second self-attested claim is don't use my proof to buy ammo. That's you add one more statement, and then my pale color is black. That's another third self-attested attribute. Okay. Once you add the proof spec, again the same thing. You take a witness, create the create the proof. The verifier will verify the proof using the proof spec and the proof, and done. So that's. Yeah, and after that I have range proof, but that might take some more time. So that's it. I'm done. Any questions?
Awesome. Any questions real quick? We're about at the end of the meeting, but we can entertain one or two.
You said this code is available in your branch of Versa?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll send you, I'll put the link in the meeting notes.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So my opinion in this is, or my qualification of opinion is very, very low since I have not worked with this stuff before, but I did find the API calls and everything else to be pretty readable. So I appreciate your work there in presenting it to us. That's the end of our meeting, folks. Thank you to everyone who was involved, and we hope you have a fantastic, if you're in the U.S. or celebrating Thanksgiving, we wish it well. We will see many of you next week at the Connectathon, and we'll have the calls next week as well. Thanks, folks.
All right.
Thanks, all.